And now I'd like to hand it to our third and final speaker, John Montgomery of University of Auckland.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. I'd just first like to recognise the expertise from the Ministry and from NIWA, Rich and John McCoy. They're both much more involved in the actual business of fisheries research than I am personally. So I've taken a somewhat broader perspective with the material that I'm covering in this briefing. And you'll see on this first slide that I've nominated as a principal reference a science paper recent just last year talking about rebuilding global fisheries. And I'll use that reasonably extensively through the talk. One of the reasons that I've chosen this paper is that it is a little bit of a consensus paper. You can see the list of authors down below the science reference there. And just the first two authors, for instance, Boris Worm and Ray Hilborn, have often been on opposite sides of the debate with respect to global fisheries, the status and the outlook for them. And here they've come together, as I say, in somewhat of a consensus paper, which includes input from New Zealand, so it can put the New Zealand situation into the international context. One point I think to make is that often fisheries is controversial because precisely of the reasons that Rich and John have pointed out, that it's information poor, and a lack of information often leads to controversy. So one of the objectives, I guess, from a science point of view is to identify those knowledge gaps and, where possible, contribute to the knowledge base underlying the debate about the future of fisheries. Just one other point I'd like to pick up from John McCoy's talk in terms of the fact that the universities can't help. I agree with John in terms of the funding side of things, and in terms of the university contribution, I think it's just worth noting that we are developing a collaboration with the University of Otago, the University of Victoria, and the University of Auckland, funded by TEC, to work collaboratively in marine space. And one of the first tasks for us is to identify the graduate demand from organisations like NIWA and MFISH, and supply the graduates with the skill base necessary to meet that demand. And clearly one of those areas is the quantitative modelling side of things that those two have both highlighted. So taking a bit of a global look at things, I've given kind of cross-references to the pictures and graphs that I've shown throughout the talk, so this is actually sourced from FAO and can be obtained off the website. But the graph just gives a kind of track of the wild catch, I guess, from 1960-odd through to when the records are available, but not right up to the current day. And one of the things obvious there with respect to the wild catch is that global wild fisheries have peaked. So somewhere in the 90s, pretty much, the global catch has increased, has levelled out, sorry. And I guess there are a couple of questions, again, that we don't have particularly good answers for, and you'll see from my talk that it's more about questions probably than answers. But one can ask the question, is the catch level being maintained by increasing fishing capacity? And I've unbundled that a bit on the next slide. So if you look at this slide, the blue curve is the increase in number of fishing vessels over a comparable sort of period. But the yellow line is probably the one to focus on, because that includes not just the increase in fishing vessels, but increases in technology, which increases the efficacy of those vessels. So that's a fishing power index. So that's increased quite steeply over this same period. So perhaps the maintenance of the current level in wild fish catches is due to increasing fishing power. And there's kind of a fundamental point with respect to fisheries, that once fisheries start to become depleted, it obviously requires more and more effort to harvest the same amount. And really that's the point from the World Bank and UN FAO report there, that inefficiency due to that may be costing as much as $50 billion worldwide in terms of fisheries. It's basically And the second point on that slide really relates to quite a lot that John McCoy was talking about with respect to where the money for research comes from. Globally, there's still very strong cross-subsidy of fishing fleets, and the figure there, I think, is related to the European cross-subsidy of something like $6 billion. And I think, in a sense, the New Zealand industry should actually be proud of the fact that they're more aligned with current efforts that are occurring in other industries, like the requirement for industry to pay the environmental and carbon costs of their activity, that the New Zealand industry is at least levied for some of the costs associated with the industry itself. So I would have said that's more in alignment with the way in which things are heading globally in other industries, and that the cross-subsidy of fisheries runs against that trend. The second major reason as to why the global catch levels may be being held up is the transfer of fishing effort from areas that have become depleted to areas that are still underutilized. And again, out of the Worms paper is this diagram here just showing the shift of that fishing effort from developed nations through to the waters surrounding Africa in the 1990s. And I guess the question for us in New Zealand is what happens as the next wave of this shift in effort? And I think the question with respect to New Zealand is what's the potential effect of this further downstream in terms of the South Pacific, international waters, deep water, and our interests in the Southern Ocean? I think probably in terms of the briefing, one of the important issues is just to look at how well New Zealand rates. And John McCoy's indicated already that New Zealand fisheries management is well respected internationally. And this global chart that comes out of the Worms paper again in terms of green areas, not overfished, yellow, low exploitation rates, orange, low to moderate, and red, high exploitation rates. It's clear that kind of Alaska and New Zealand hold an enviable position with respect to what we know about the status of our fisheries. However, the question again arises, we may be doing well, but is well good enough? And again, from a kind of global perspective, the ecosystems that were examined in the study account for something less than a quarter of the world's fisheries area and catch. And those that are likely to moderately fished and rebuilding comprise less than half of that. So we're talking about 12% of the world's fisheries that fall into that category. So globally, there's still a real issue. And it's very likely that the fisheries that have been studied here are, in fact, the better managed fisheries. They're the ones for which data is available. And we know far less about that other three quarters where the information is not available to make those assessments. I guess the positive element of this study is that with appropriate management, fisheries, even those that have been overfished, can recover. The other point I'd make alongside this is that New Zealand does have a good international reputation with respect to fisheries management, but also with respect to marine conservation. And there's another reference here for you from an April 2007 National Geographic, which deals with the status of the world's fisheries and singles out New Zealand's record in conservation, particularly around marine protected areas, as a model which in some respects you can argue was generated here and has propagated internationally. I've tried to list here what I see as some of the major knowledge gaps and major issues facing us more from a New Zealand perspective. Often in fisheries management and as part of the policy environment within which fisheries management is conducted in New Zealand, there's a requirement to consider ecosystems effects of fishing. And just as one example of that is the issue of bottom trawling, which is a very significant issue and may be highly damaging in some circumstances and not at all in others. And it's very difficult to gauge exactly what those effects are, but it's certainly an area where New Zealand and New Zealand industry needs to be keeping a weather eye If for no other reason, then it's one of the key factors that environmental sustainability is premised against marketing. So there is a significant kind of marketing risk, if you like, with respect to bottom trawling. And just illustrating the ways in which bottom trawling or dredging may affect fisheries in quite subtle and difficult to establish ways is that, for instance, scallop dredging, particularly recreational scallop dredging in some areas, may be destroying bottom habitat, which is important for larval settlement and survival. And again, just to use a local example of that, in Cowell Bay, we know in the cable zone around Cowell that there's quite extensive bottom sponge habitat. And outside that area where the scallop dredging occurs, that habitat is really been pretty much reduced to broken shell and sand. And if you look at the snapper larval densities inside the cable zone versus outside, they're much higher. So we don't at this point know whether settlement habitat is a bottleneck in terms of the juveniles coming through to the fishery. But if that were the case, the destruction of that complex habitat may be having a significant effect. Just quickly through some of the other points that I've listed here, the knowledge gaps that John McCoy identified really kind of give rise to the precautionary principle, the idea that where we don't have sufficient knowledge, we should be managing the fisheries conservatively. And I guess just one additional point I'd like to add into that is the idea that under management based on that principle, there is a clear incentive to know more, which may encourage more research funding into those areas. Some of the other areas where we've got active research that I think could help, again, associated with the costs of determining what's out there from ship-based work, there are some really elegant and sophisticated new technologies for remote sensing that are coming into place that may be able to bridge some of those knowledge gaps. There are interesting suggestions, but again, not much in the way of hard evidence for evolutionary effects of pressure change. And again, this is just one of the concerns that if you've consistently fished a population down to the minimum legal length, what are the evolutionary pressures and the evolutionary responses to that? Do the fish grow faster but to smaller size and mature earlier? And we just don't know in terms of those sort of decadal effects what the effects of fishing consistently are. And then I've got another slide that will talk a little bit about larval biology and population connectivity, and another one just to illustrate some of our current work in terms of marine protected areas as possibly part of management or mitigation of some of the effects that I listed above. So again, if one looks at the life cycle of many of our commercial species, typically they spawn many eggs. The larvae are produced at a very early stage of development and spend considerable time in the plankton before settling and growing to join the fish population. And if one looks at the fisheries research money that's being spent, it's largely in the bottom right corner with respect to the fished population. But clearly all other aspects of the life cycle are really important, and larval survival and particularly the settlement issues that I referred to earlier may well be significant ways in which we can intervene to improve fisheries. And finally, with respect to fisheries, to marine protected areas with respect to fisheries, one of the questions we would really like to know the answer to is whether protected areas that have quite dense populations of large fish. So the bar graph to the bottom right of that figure, the red, shows the size distribution of fish within the marine reserve. The small grey bars in front are the size distribution of the population immediately outside the reserve. And the blue circle on the headland, just here, is the extent of the marine reserve. So some of the modelling that we've currently been doing is look at tidal modelling. The colour codes there go shallow to deep, red to blue, And this is the distribution of fish eggs and larvae once they've reached settlement. You can see them being shifted by the tides out of the marine reserve down past Kawau, Whangapua, Tiri, down into the Gulf. And clearly those that survive become part of the fishery. What we'd really like is some quantitative estimate of what significance, if any, that contribution has. And I'll end on that note. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. I'd like to open it up now to questions. Thank you very much for your patience. To everyone who's been waiting, I'll unmute the participants now, so bear with me for a moment while the audio comes back online. All right, you should now be all able to speak. So do we have any questions from the journalists of Dalton?
It's Nick Churchhouse here from the Dominion Post.
Hi,
looking at John McCoy's presentation. Thanks for that, John. You mentioned a couple of times the uncertainty we have around fish stocks is not handled well by the types of decision processes we use. You also highlighted that the QMS is based on maximum sustainable yield. Do you think the decision processes are flawed in how we decide on the general TACT? TST limits.
I wouldn't use the word flawed. What I would say is I think we can do better. Because the reality is that people who have to make decisions in this area are having to deal with a good deal of uncertainty. And putting off decisions, as Rich pointed out with respect to the John, with the precautionary principle, putting off decisions because you don't think you know enough, or because there's too great an uncertainty, is a really fundamental philosophy that we've kind of signed up to with the law of the sea and all the rest of it. But actually making those decisions in the light of whatever level of uncertainty is actually very, very hard. I just think we can do it better in terms of how we balance those unknowns and how we evaluate the risks. I think it's now done in a very informal kind of way in the process, and I think there's a whole lot of opportunity to use better organised, better thought through decision processes to handle that, rather than the current process, which frankly is highly susceptible to influence from particular vested interests.
Just on that, given what you've just said, and that roughly 500 out of 600 of our quota management species are effectively unknown, do you think it's therefore, when you say we should desist in the face of uncertainty, would you not then follow that we should not be fishing those species?
It's a matter of degree. I think we can handle the uncertainty better. We can focus in on what elements of information about those fish or the fisheries for them that would contribute a bit more certainty. At the moment, we distribute most of our resources into a few species. There is an approach which could distribute some of those resources to some of the less demanding species, if you like, in terms of the economic value, and we wouldn't end up in a situation, I think, where you wouldn't fish for them at all, but you would at least have some better basic information to make some decisions. I'd also make the point that there's a kind of relationship between the funding that a particular species, for example, gets and the importance of that fishery, because the funding is coming from the particular quota holders for those particular species. So there's a natural tendency for whatever money is spent on research to be focused towards the bigger, more important fisheries in an economic sense. There's certainly no incentive for anybody to focus on what might be the more ecologically important issues or those minor species. And in part, it's worthwhile noting that most of the funding for fisheries research is coming from the fishing industry. The government itself, on behalf of the public, doesn't put much in at all. And it may well be worth considering the whole funding model in a way that both has the public contributing more, but also has some of these species or areas or questions which fall between the cracks because of the particular incentives on the other side of it to be looked at.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Other questions on the floor?
Sorry, if I might add my 5 cents on that question. Sorry, it's Rich Ford.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Rich.
I agree with a lot of what John said, but I guess in the face of shrinking budgets and a recession in the fisheries management sphere, it's a case of trade-offs. It's a case of how much precaution do you use in your management versus the economic benefits on the other side. And like John, I definitely agree that more money could be going into fisheries management, particularly from the government point of view as well, to help deal with a lot of that uncertainty. And you know, it's an area we're working on, but it's definitely not an area where there's a lot of quick and easy fixes.
Thanks, Rich. Other questions?
Yes, Sid Pickering here from CP New Zealand magazine.
Go ahead, Sid.
Just a question for John Montgomery on bottom trawling. It seems to be a popular conception that bottom trawling kills all habitats. That's a direct quote from the Greenpeace website. And John, I noticed you mentioned that in some instances it has a minimal effect on ecosystems and in some instances none. Can you just expand on that in a New Zealand context and in an international one?
Hopefully.
Certainly. John Montgomery here. I think the point that I was making is that it's kind of being taken as a given that bottom trawling is bad everywhere, and that's being picked up as a way of eco-labelling a product. And I'm just not convinced in my own mind that that's necessarily the case under all circumstances. And but if you push me to give an example of where I thought bottom trawling was okay, I'd be hard-pressed to actually put my finger on something where I knew the data and it was established. It's just I'm questioning that presumption and just saying maybe that's an area that we need to know more about.
Rich Ford here. I could possibly give some examples that might help. If you're talking about trawling for surf clams in the wave zones of beaches, these are areas that are highly physically dynamic, where the sand moves around, and you know, about an hour after you've put a surf clam through that area, there are no physical signs that you've done that. Whereas if you were to look at deep sea cold water corals, that are extremely brittle and long lived, and if you were to put a trawl through that, then I would expect you to see, you know, very significant damage. So there, you know, there's areas that are hydrodynamically very active, and where the structures are not delicate, they're adapted to being in those hydrodynamically active circumstances, those might be the ones that are less susceptible to things like trawling.
Thanks.
John Montgomery, could I ask Rich Ford a question, just on a follow-up from that?
Go ahead.
Just what's your feeling with respect to the Hoki side of things, Rich, in that that's one area that has been kind of identified in some of the recent press, that they're advising people not to take Hoki or not to eat Hoki because of it's taken by bottom trawling, and yet my kind of understanding is that the bottom trawling is done with some sophistication there, and there may well be an argument that it isn't destructive in the sense it is in other places. How do you feel about that?
As always, once you get into these questions, they're more and more complex. A lot of the Hoki trawling is done on spawning aggregations and is mid-water sort of capture, and therefore it doesn't impact on the bottom. Most of the impact on the bottom, my belief, and I'm not a specialist in this particular area, is more likely to be on the Chatham Rise. And I think it's one of those questions where it's very hard to make broad generalisations that all fishing for hoki is bad. It might be that trawling or capturing hoki in certain fisheries, say on the Cook Strait or West Coast South Island, that you're not having benthic impacts at all, but over on the Chatham Rise you might be having some benthic impacts. And there are certain benthic protected areas, as you know, in place around New Zealand. The representativeness of those benthic protected areas could be argued, and I believe we can improve on those, but there's definitely large parts of the New Zealand EEZ, around about a third, where there is not trawling. Now, those tend to be in the deeper, less productive waters, but again, it's hard to make those generalisations.
Thanks very much. I think we will be... Yes?
Sorry, Daisy, John McCoy here. Could I just make one general comment on that whole question as well?
Yes, you may.
Yeah, there's actually two or three key points about this question of the effects of trawling. One is, it's not so much a question of whether trawling does a particular kind of damage. That's the variable, as Rich says, but it's also a question of how extensive within habitats that trawling is. So if there's areas that are not trawled, that are suitable or extensive enough, then it seems to me it's not fair to argue that the whole fishery should be condemned. Secondly, there's a huge double standard here. We accept massive changes through activities on land. And whilst that's not necessarily a good thing, the standard that's being applied to the fishing industry in making these kinds of claims is totally unreasonable. And it's overgeneralised and lacking in any thought for the standards that apply. Third thing, just briefly, mm-hmm. One of the things we don't often ask about is what's the effect of changing habitat by fishing on the actual state or the productivity of those fisheries themselves. It's not just an ecological question, it's a straight-out production question, and John Montgomery touched on that in his talk. And I think there should be a lot more questions being asked about that and suitably supported with good quality research.
Hi, it's Isabella Cawthorn from the Ministry of Research, Science and Technology. Dacia, am I clear to ask a question?
Go ahead, Isabella.
Hi, thanks very much for those presentations. That was, just superb and very interesting indeed for most. I'm not sure if there are any Foundation people listening in, but one of the things that we're really interested in getting views on is the relationship between what you might call research in fisheries and the traditionally much broader science. And science is deemed to include the kind of ongoing monitoring and gathering of data that informs a lot of the big multivariate models that might be more called research. And this is relevant because, as you'll all be hopefully aware, the Crown Research Institute Task Force has come back with its report. And we're now having to start looking at how the government, through Vote RS&T, funds research and science to help departments fund their own research and science. And this is, where exactly you might draw the line between science, as in sort of monitoring and so on, and the more research. Research-oriented stuff with that might perhaps require people with PhDs and possibly supercomputers, as opposed to people with technical qualifications. That's an issue that we're going to have to put a lot of effort into thinking about. So I'd be interested in people's views on that. Sorry, that was a very long question.
So it's John Montgomery here. I mean, I could... start off if that's appropriate.
Go ahead. Yeah.
It's a very difficult line to draw. I certainly wouldn't accept the proposition that the fisheries stock assessment type work is just a technical operation and doesn't require folk of a really kind of high caliber PhD level the modelling is quite sophisticated, and if anything, we find it easier to get the quality graduates in the kind of stroke more biology than the quantitative side of things, and that's one of the areas that we're looking to address through this sort of joint collaboration with Otago and Vic, is identify those gaps and push them through. I mean, even on the science level, and I think the knowledge that is required for the management of the fisheries covers the whole spectrum from the kind of trawl survey type work and the database that John and Rich talked about, kind of right through to a better understanding of the biology involved to take a more kind of holistic ecosystems kind of approach. So I don't think there is any clear demarcation myself.
No.
I think that may be a good place to leave it, but if anyone has a final burning question, put your hand up now.
I have just one more quick question. Nick Church asked from the Dominion Post again, perhaps for the two Johns. I'm just interested to know the amount of talk we've had about the various research that's done within New Zealand's EEZ. Is there... in the context of the wider, the greater ocean, I mean, obviously there's no rail and post with number 8 fencing wire around our EEZ. Does the research that we do within our waters, is it affected by what's happening outside to any great degree? How does that affect the confidence in the results?
John McCaughey, that's actually a hard one to answer. New Zealand's lucky in that physically we're not close to anybody else's EEZs, and what's more, there's not much fishing done in the immediate boundaries around our EEZ by others, except in the case of some of the highly migratory species in the past. So in terms of physical impacts on New Zealand systems by activities outside, I'd suggest there isn't much to be concerned about.
And I might just add to Tom Montgomery here, just taking kind of a wider view. I mean, I agree with what John McCoy's just said. But it does strike me that New Zealand is doing a pretty good job of its coastal fisheries, and it is an area that, I mean, we've got fourth or fifth largest exclusive economic zone, depending on how you count it. It is an area that we could be contributing on the world stage, perhaps more than we are. So taking a slightly more kind of outward-looking view of the way in which we undertake fisheries management here and where that model might propagate.
All right. Thank you very much to all of our speakers and to those of you who've dialed in. We will need to leave it there.